TUC Radio San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Satish Kumar, From Monk to Activist, Part 2. Last week you heard of Satish Kumar's three journeys. Still a child, he joined the Jain Order and walked barefoot across India with his begging bowl. Influenced by Gandhi's writings, he ran away from the order at age 18 and became an activist in the land reform movement. Kumar then read about the 90-year-old philosopher Bertrand Russell, who had been imprisoned for his anti-nuclear resistance. He and a friend decided to join Russell's movement and walk from India to the capitals of the then four nuclear powers. The 8,000-mile journey took them 2.5 years. And on last week's program, Satish Kumar talked about his adventures and thoughts during these long walks. Now you will hear the interview that he gave me the following day. I was curious what his relationship to E.F. Schumacher, the legendary author of the almost cult classic status book, Small is Beautiful, was. After all, Kumar co-founded the college that bears Schumacher's name and is a teacher there. E.F. Schumacher was born in Germany in 1911. In the 1930s, he fled from the Nazis to England. Although he was interned as an enemy alien during the war, he was able to help the British government with its economic and financial war mobilization. From 1950 to 1970, he was chief economic advisor to the British Coal Board, one of the world's largest organizations with 800,000 employees. He predicted the rise of OPEC and the problems of nuclear power. In 1955, Schumacher traveled to Burma. While there, he developed the principles of what he called Buddhist economics, based on the belief that production from local resources for local needs is the most rational way of economic life. He also became a pioneer of what is now called appropriate technology. I asked Satish Kumar to remember for us the day he met E.F. Schumacher. Satish Kumar.
When I first time saw him and met him, he invited me for lunch. And we went to an Italian restaurant. And he said that unfortunately I have meetings and I'm very busy with paperwork and so on. So we can only have about 1 hour over lunch. But when we started talking, we found each other so simpatico that we spent 3 hours together. And then we came up to his office and he gave me his essay on Buddhist economics. And he said that when he was sent by the British government to Burma, he was sent there to advise the Burmese government and Burmese people for economic development. But before he finished his assignment, he discovered that Burmese have a perfectly good economic system and they don't need Western economic advisors. And so he returned before finishing his job and wrote this paper called Buddhist Economics. And the draft of it, he gave it as a report to his government officials. And one of the officials asked him, "Your paper is strangely titled. What Buddhism has to do with economics?" So Schumacher jokingly said to these officials that economics without Buddhism, without spiritual values, without human values, without ecological values, without Buddhism, is like sex without love. And so the official was very sort of shocked and shy and embarrassed. So that's how Schumacher saw that all our physical, economic, political, social activities must be informed by deep values. Call them Buddhist, call them Christian, call them spiritual, call them human, call them ecological. It's the question of deep values. reverence for life. And those are the values he explained in Buddhist economics. The text is in the book now, Small is Beautiful. There's a chapter there called Buddhist Economics, and you can reproduce it.
And here's a brief excerpt from Buddhist Economics. Right livelihood is one of the requirements of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. It is clear, therefore, that there must be such a thing as Buddhist economics. The Buddhist point of view takes the function of work to be at least threefold: to give a man a chance to utilize and develop his faculties, to enable him to overcome his egocentredness by joining with other people in a common task, and to bring forth the goods and services needed for a becoming existence. Again, the consequences that flow from this view are endless. To organize work in such a manner that it becomes meaningless, boring, stultifying, or nerve-wracking for the worker would be little short of criminal. It would indicate a greater concern with goods than with people, an evil lack of compassion, and a soul-destroying degree of attachment to the most primitive side of this worldly existence. Equally, to strive for leisure as an alternative to work would be considered a complete misunderstanding of one of the most basic truths of human existence, namely that work and leisure are complementary parts of the same living process and cannot be separated without destroying the joy of work and the bliss of leisure. That's a brief excerpt from Buddhist Economics by E.F. Schumacher. And now back to the interview with Satish Kumar. To juxtapose a piece about Buddhist economics with the market system we are dealing with here would be really interesting and make people think more about what the free market idea actually means.
Actually, what people are calling free market is not free at all. It is a kind of sort of using the word and abusing the word free and freedom. So I would not call it free market. So what they are trying to do is to impose a global monoculture on the world and destroy the cultural diversity, destroy the local economy, destroy the local democracy and local systems. So whenever you have such a global monolithic monoculture, where wherever you go, whether Thailand or Burma or India or Europe or America or Japan or Australia, you get same kind of food, same kind of architecture, same kind of clothing, same kind of McDonald's and Coca-Cola. That is not a free market. The free market is actually destroying the markets, the small, local, indigenous markets, and imposing this global capitalism, monopolistic capitalism. So this is a free market is a contradiction in terms. What they mean really is stock market. What they really mean is Wall Street and the exchange of money, which trillions of dollars and pounds move around the world with a push of a button. That is not free market. That is a few clever, technologically advanced people exploiting and creating a hegemony on ordinary, simple, maybe uneducated peasant society, which has wisdom, culture, tradition, mythology, religion, their own way of life. But this monolithic market economy or so-called capitalist economy is only interested in making profit. And they look at the world and see it as a market, not a vast continent of cultural diversity where people live and make things, build things, grow things, and they have their own culture. they are just looking at the world in terms of how much resources we can get and how much our goods we can sell. This is totally a materialistic worldview, and it is sweeping the world like a flood. Unfortunately, all the traditional cultures are succumbing to it, cultures of India and China, such ancient cultures, but the governments and the business people are in cahoot and in a sort of conspiracy against their own peoples and cultures, because these government leaders and industrial leaders and traders and businessmen, they are also succumbed and mesmerized with this materialistic sort of glamour.
The market really destroys value by giving everything a price in monetary terms.
That's right, that's right. What is called free trade is actually free raid. And what we need is a balance of economic conditions and spiritual cultural values. Because ecology is the most important new word which we need to understand. And ecology means a balanced relationship with the external world. If our relationship with the trees and the rivers and the plants, forests, and the earth and the planet in general is not healthy, then however many high-rise Empire State buildings and twin towers you build, and however many big airports and jumbo jets you build, and however many fast computer programs you create, the real well-being of human beings will not be fulfilled. So for me, an ecological worldview is very important. But there are two ways to look at ecology. One is utilitarian ecology, where we say the trees and forests and rivers and the soil are important for human benefit, and therefore we must take care of them for the benefit of human society. That is, in my view, utilitarian ecology. I prefer reverential ecology, where we say tree has intrinsic value. Earth, water, air, fire have intrinsic value, and therefore they are sacred. Earth is sacred, water is sacred, fire is sacred, forests are sacred. And so reverence for all life, so that we can practice the principles of non-violence and non-harming to all beings, that kind of deep and profound reverence and respect for the ecology and the environment and the animals and the humans, that is, I call, reverential ecology. And we need to develop that, because even the environmental movement is very rationalistic and materialistic, and they are looking at the issues of conservation and protection of the environment from a very human-centered, materialistic view. And still they believe the supremacy of the human beings, and somehow human beings have a sort of birthright to kill animals, have factory farmings, and use forests for their benefit to build houses, furniture. So reverential ecology is the essential message which I am giving to the environmentalists, that move out of this materialistic, utilitarian environmentalism and go for reverential environmentalism.
And in that, you introduce love into the equation.
Absolutely. How can you protect environment if you don't know it? If you don't go out in nature, if you don't walk in the forest, if you don't swim in the sea, if you don't walk along the river, if you don't know it, and if you don't love it, then just an intellectual abstract idea of protecting the environment doesn't appeal to me. So I say to, for example, friends of the earth, that if you are truly friends of the earth, go and work on the earth and live close to the earth and walk upon the earth and touch the earth and feel the earth and be one with the earth. That is true friendship. If you are always working and campaigning from your offices, sitting in front of a computer screen, and you say, I'm friend of the earth, how can you be a friend of the earth even if you don't see the earth? How can you be a friend of somebody and you never have dinner with them, never have lunch with them, never go out with them, never see them, never have conversation with them? So we need to engage in a conversation with the earth. And therefore, outdoor life is very, very essential to be a true friend of the earth.
There's one more thought I would like to bring up. Your first march for land with Vinoba, the struggle for land and what's at the heart of the Zapatista rebellion now. If you were in Chiapas, what would you say to peasants now doing what you helped them to do with your march?
You see, the change and transformation of any society or any individual being or any community is an ongoing process. It is not a short-term process. It is a long-term process. And therefore, we must use means of transformation in congruity and in harmony with the ends of our movement. Therefore, however worthy the movement is and however worthy the aims and objects and goals of the movement are, the means must be right. That was Gandhi's message. So, in whatever situation, we must use means of persuasion and protest with nonviolence and resistance with nonviolence and compassion. A compassionate resistance, a compassionate protest, and a compassionate movement will bring better and lasting results. So that would be my advice anywhere. And land reform is very important, because if people have no means of livelihood, if they cannot grow their own food, and if they cannot build their own house on the land which is under their feet, then we are living in a deeply unjust social order. Therefore, I would appeal to landlords in South America, in Africa, in Asia, wherever, that share your land with your peasants, with your workers, with your landless people. Then their work on the land will be even more productive. And if you have a social harmony, if you have political harmony, then economic well-being will be the fruit of that social and political harmony. So land reform for me is a great project for the 21st century. And land reform stands above all other projects, whatever the global economy and the global services, and we think that we can bring development to people. No lasting development can happen unless people have land.
People looking for land now don't always face individual landowners anymore, as you mainly did on your march, but they face World Bank projects of dams that displace millions of people from their land, or agribiz corporations or mining operations that are just absorbing land.
Those big companies and big organizations like World Bank and oil companies like BP and Shell, I think a mass movement against those big companies is in order. And we must organize such mass campaign. But such mass campaign should be organized on the principles of nonviolence and compassion and patience and not hatred. Because in all big companies, human beings are only human beings. They are caught up in the wave of this capitalist free market conditioning of the mind. So we need to decondition their mind. We need to transform their minds. So however cruel the enemy and the opponent, we must remain compassionate and non-violent. And there are great examples in India, for example, Medha Patkar and Baba Amte campaigning against the building of big dams on the Narmada River is a great example. And also Sundarlal Bahuguna in Tehri, in the Himalayas, North India, is campaigning against big dam there. And these campaigns, even if they don't succeed immediately in that one particular place, will have great effect on World Bank and other big commercial organizations. And they will think twice to plan a big dam in some other place because they know how people stand up in outrage when their livelihoods and their countryside and their land is destroyed and flooded and their communities are displaced. So these campaigns have a long-lasting effect. We must not underestimate the influence and the impact of these great resistance movements.
You work with Vandana Shiva too.
Yes.
And she is, for me, she is, well, all her work is really interesting and amazing. But what she has said about biotechnology and the absorption of the seed and the deadening of the seed with terminated genes and the resistance of peasants in India, even to the degree, I don't know if that falls under violent action to burn down a field of genetically engineered crop. Do you have any comments about the biotechnology issues and the proper resistance to that?
For me, Mahatma Gandhi was a supreme example of how to organize nonviolent campaign. And he organized burning of imported British-made clothes. And he urged people to go out with their imported factory-made British clothes in the squares of their towns and cities and light big bonfire and then never again buy any factory-made, imported from foreign countries, especially Britain, clothes. Now, that to me was a perfectly non-violent action. In the same way, if there are genetically engineered and genetically modified crops being planted, and if people non-violently and compassionately and without hatred in their heart come together to organize a symbolic action and burn the crops, and be prepared to be arrested and go to jail and suffer the consequence, then I think that is a perfectly non-violent direct action, and I will totally approve of such actions.
Do you have something to say about, I don't have the words really for it to describe what's going on here, but that corporations should take power over the seed, which is the kernel of our life, and make it into a commodity and deaden its and alter it in gross ways, and also, you know, with inserting the terminated gene, destroying its ability to reproduce.
Obviously, I am against such genetic engineering and such modification, genetic modification, and I'm against terminator technology. I feel this, we have to have a reverential ecology, and terminator technology totally disrespects and uses seed as a commodity, utilitarian approach to seeds. So obviously I am totally against such activity. What I feel is that when you have seed, you have to look at it as a seed of the gods. Because gods have put that potential, that energy into the seed, which has potential to become a great tree. And from that tree, thousands of more seeds will come out, and thousands of more fruit and flower, year after year after year. If you stop that process and say, seed can be grown only once and never again, and you have to go to a commercial company to buy new seed every year, for me, that is interfering in the divine process. And you are interfering in the process of the gods. And that is insult to gods. Therefore, I say, there can be no greater sin than to disturb and destroy the true potential of the seed, which is to grow year after year after year and produce thousands of times more seeds. So for me, this is blasphemous. I use religious language for it. This is blasphemous. This is insult to gods. And this is, in religious terms, a sin. And therefore, it should not be allowed.
That was an interview with Satish Kumar, former Jain monk, follower of Mahatma Gandhi's teachings, and author of Path Without Destination. He's co-founder of Schumacher College and editor and publisher of the magazine Resurgence. He now lives in England. You can get a copy of the full one-hour tape with Satish Kumar for $12. The talk includes last week's program on his life as a monk and the 8,000-mile walk for nuclear disarmament. TUC Radio relies on listener support. Your tape order is welcome. It allows us to continue our work. Our address is TUC Radio, Box 41009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 41009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For a credit card order, call anytime toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or go to our website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening.